This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers Podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Brewster, Stacey Cole, and Todd Michaels.
Michael McKee was a vascular surgeon with no criminal record who allegedly drove 300 miles from Chicago to Columbus to execute his ex-wife and her husband while their two children slept nearby. The marriage lasted 7 months. The divorce was finalized in 2017. Police say they found the murder weapon in McKee's penthouse about 11 days after the killings. He's now facing two counts of aggravated murder, charges that could put him away for life without parole. So what does the prosecution need to prove? And how do they do it when there are no eyewitnesses and the defendant is a smart, successful doctor who's never been in trouble? Joining us, Eric Faddis, defense attorney, former prosecutor, to help us break all this down from a legal perspective. Let's start looking at all this from the prosecution standpoint. McKee was initially charged with the murder. Then it was upgraded to aggravated murder. What are we talking about here? What kind of specific elements are going into place when prosecutors upgrade the verbiage there? And obviously the severity of the crime to aggravated. What is that signal and how they're framing this case, Eric?
Sure. So the original murder charge required the prosecution prove that this was an intentional killing, that he caused the deaths of two people, and that he did that willfully. The aggravation comes with this added element of prior calculation and design. Some jurisdictions call it premeditation. It's essentially that he planned this out, that he took measures to build up to this, and he knew what he was doing, and it happened over a period of time. And then on top of that, there's also kind of a firearm enhancer because a firearm was used in the deaths. And so that's what really ups the ante in terms of the aggravated murder is the prior calculation and design allegation.
Police reportedly recovered the murder weapon from McKee's Chicago apartment 11 days after the murders. It was a Nibin match, allegedly confirming a ballistic match to shell casings from the actual scene. How devastating is it that you have this kind of evidence? You have a Nibin match going on here, which is interesting as to why you'd even have a gun that's in the Nibin system. But, you know, you can buy them at pawn shops and stuff. Who knows? Can defense attorneys realistically challenge the forensic firearms analysis in 2026 here if it goes beyond preliminary match and turns out to be a pretty solid match here?
You know, the alleged Nibin match is certainly problematic for the defense, of course. It sort of links the alleged murder weapon to this guy. That being said, you know, it's not every science has weaknesses. There are ways to challenge these sorts of ballistics analyses. And, you know, we're talking about markings on casings. We're talking about types of casings used. We're talking about other findings forensically that can be challenged, but you know, there's kind of the CSI effect with jurors when they hear, hey, this is there's science behind this, defense has got trouble.
Yeah, when there's the science behind it. McKee allegedly gave police a bogus alibi initially before invoking his right to remain silent. What do you take on that? I mean, it's interesting that he said anything when police were starting to question him. I mean, if you did it, I would think maybe you'd just be like, talk to my attorney right away. But the fact that he was willing and able to give some sort of alibi that then, well, didn't really turn out to be too accurate. How do you take that if you're looking at this case from a prosecution standpoint where the story changes? And if you got nothing to change, why would you be giving a bogus story?
I mean, that's the thing, is it? Yeah. It sort of, from a prosecutorial standpoint, Tony, reeks of deception. Why would he need to throw off law enforcement if he was, you know, at a baseball game or somewhere else? Why would he need to lie about his whereabouts when these two gruesome murders were committed? Certainly, it's beyond suspicious. It shows a consciousness of guilt. And at the trial phase, it's potentially going to be used against him to show this deception. And also, if he testifies, they're going to be able to pepper him on cross-examination saying, hey, from the very beginning, you lied to police. Why should we believe you now?
Well, yeah. Especially being a physician, this is somebody who takes an oath You know, they are moral and supposed to be moral and ethically, you know, professional. And now he's lying to another credentialed type of a agency. It doesn't make a lot of sense unless you're trying to deceive people. It's not going to play well for him at all.
It's a really good point. You know, lawyers, the profession that I'm in, we have a duty of candor, not only to the court, but in a general sense to everybody else. We mm-hmm. keep just engage in these flagrant misrepresentations. And I imagine there's some kind of ethical canon in the medical field, or there should be, or at least the jurors are going to see it as such by saying, hey, this is a licensed professional and he's lying to the cops. That really sort of cast doubt on what might be seen as sort of a sterling background of at least no criminal history.
What's interesting is he went back to work after the murders for a period of time. And we're starting to learn some information, unconfirmed as of right now, but I'm just starting to read about this morning from some pretty reputable sources. The allegation is this, if it's true, but I'm going to go with probably, considering the sources that it's coming from. Excuse me. There's allegations now that when he went back to work, he performed surgery. Someone has died, allegedly, who he performed surgery on. In the days after the murders. I believe it was a surgery performed around January 8th of this year, so like a week and a half ago or so, or 2 weeks. I don't have all the details, none of that. Someone could have died. You know, this could have just been natural.
Right.
We tried the surgery, didn't work. I don't have the details. But I would imagine that might be ripe for a malpractice suit of some shape or form, considering the man might not have been in the best mind state to be performing vascular surgery in the days after murdering some people. How do you think this is going to go for whoever's the family, whoever just died after being operated on by McKay, allegedly?
Well, gosh, if that did happen, there is certainly a potential malpractice lawsuit against McKay that could be brought. But this could creep in some form or fashion to the criminal case. If mm-hmm. I'm a prosecutor, I'm looking at this and saying, hey, after a person commits two grisly murders, they might be kind of shaken up. They might be off their game at work. And is this evidence that of the sort of aftermath, the psychological mechanisms that were going on inside Dr. McKay's head, that manifested in some alleged malpractice? Is that just further evidence that is consistent with a person who just killed two people and is jarred by that experience, perhaps?
I'm kind of starting to wonder a little bit more. I mean, if I would think anybody who had any sort of experience with McKay over the last, 8 years, I'd be a little concerned. I'm really wondering what the track record is. Obviously, there have been some malpractice suits against him. He's pretty much tried to avoid them, allegedly, by skipping town and giving fake addresses and such. I'd really be wondering about this. Are we at the tip of an iceberg here of what's the survival rate for McKay's patients over the last 8 years? I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's pure speculation right now.
Interesting point, though.
But this guy seems to be a bit of a wound collector. I don't think I'd want to have surgery done by him on one of his bad weeks or weeks that he's felt slighted by somebody else.
Yeah, I mean, gosh, what is the survival rate not only of his patients, but the people with whom he comes in contact in life, allegedly?
Yeah.
It seems like death is following this man, or perhaps accompanying him in some fashion, if these allegations are true, and certainly adds a deeper level of macabre to an already kind of gruesome set of circumstances.
Well, it really does. Karen in our chat said, I really hope someone has checked to make sure his parents are still alive.
I don't know the story on that. I mean,
I don't either, but I
don't know anything about it. I mean, yeah, I would think I don't know. Maybe they're gone, but not necessarily by his hand, but who knows? I would just be really curious to see if this guy ran through a path of destruction throughout his life, or if this is more In recent years, where the wound collecting really ramped up, reports indicate that neighbors may have seen McKee near the Tepe home days before the murders, which would be really interesting because that's a 300-mile drive. If prosecutors can establish surveillance or stalking behavior prior to the killings, how does that shape this narrative for premeditation?
You know, if they can establish that, it's very supportive of a prior calculation or design. It shows that this wasn't kind of some heat of passion thing. It's not like, you know, some bar altercation that ensues and escalates to a death. It's something that a person allegedly planned for a period of time. It seems predatory in a sense, if these allegations are true, that they're sort of, you know, stalking their prey over a period of time, learning the, you know, how that person moves, where they go, when they leave the house, when they're in the house, when there is no one else around the house. And those are the circumstances the government says gave rise to these killings.
It's going to be difficult for the prosecution. I mean, the digital evidence is going to be very telling and all that, if it's there. But let's just for a moment, you know, say there's not a lot of digital trail here of showing that there was this angst, this hate, this whatever feeling you want to call it towards Monique leading up to it, at least digitally. Is it going to be a hard one to connect dots on? The divorce is in 2017, the murders in 25. Is it going to be difficult to establish motive when there is that 8-year gap if there isn't a lot of evidence, you know, showing a buildup?
That could be a challenge for prosecution because this type of behavior, when we're talking about stalking, when we're talking about domestic violence-esque type of measures taken, harassment, things like that, those often happen behind closed doors. It's not something that happens like when you're out at a football game with thousands of witnesses. And they do this on purpose because they can avoid detection and they can also sort of exert their own control through this limited channel within which they are subjecting their alleged victim to that. But who else sees that? You know, the wife is dead. Her husband is dead. They can't be witnesses. Mm-hmm. Did she tell family members? Did she tell friends? Did she tell colleagues? They're going to look at statements that could have been made to these folks that might have been consistent with these stalking allegations.
How much weight can they put in that and how admissible is that? Because, I mean, essentially it's kind of hearsay-ish, isn't it? I mean, if you have family members, and they do, they exist, they have said, family members have described McKee as emotionally abusive based on what Monique had told them while she was alive. Always worried about him coming and doing something, apparently. That's powerful stuff for 8 years after a divorce that you're still mm-hmm. worried about him, not in a sense of I worry for his well-being, but are you worried about what he's going to decide to do at some point in time? Certainly very important to the context of this, but again, it's you know, it's someone's feelings being reiterated to a family member. A lot of people, you know, some people have feelings like that and they're completely unfounded. Obviously, there's some more founding to this and more grounding to it, considering what allegedly took place here. Is all of that open for getting out into the ether of a trial, all of the things that Monique may have said to her family members over those years?
Not necessarily. There are kind of two potential impediments. One is, as you mentioned, the evidentiary prohibition on hearsay, which is an out-of-court statement. So Monique made these statements out of court, and now she cannot testify to them because she is deceased. Also, there is the Constitution's Confrontation Clause, which essentially says if the prosecution is going to bring some statement from a person and use it against you as evidence, you as a defendant get to confront that person. Well, if that person is no longer around, there is no such confrontation. And so usually a lot of those statements might be barred. The jury might not even hear the full picture of this, which is, of course, concerning.
What do you think the odds are here that he has a clear digital footprint, that he cleared his history, that he kept it out, and he was smart enough to not leave a trail there, considering the fact that he's allegedly kept the damn weapon? I mean, it's kind of like sometimes you see folks like this where it's like, you did this, but you didn't do that. although more times than not, one's kind of a tell about one's own housekeeping, especially if they seem to have somewhat of narcissistic qualities about them of better than the rest of the world, outsmarting the rest of the world, smartest man in the room. Kind of, you know, if we're reading him, just my own conjecture, he kind of exudes that sort of a feel about him. So I'm wondering, you know, is this a guy who did keep tabs on that and cleared the history to avoid detection? Or is it one of those where he thought he was too smart for the room? No one's ever going to look there anyhow.
You know, I think there are a number of considerations. One, you know, he is a high level doctor. He's a vascular surgeon. You know, we would think of those people as being meticulous, as being careful, yeah, as really taking their time and thinking through all of their actions. On the other hand, with an absence of criminal history, he appears to not be a professional criminal. So professional criminals are sometimes hip to this digital forensics game and can engage in certain measures like having burner phones, like using different IP addresses, going to the library. There are all sorts of things that can be done. But the fact that he's kind of appears to be an alleged amateur criminal tells me that there might be some gems within that digital footprint that he left behind. And we'll have to see.
It kind of makes you wonder. You go into the library and you see somebody using the free internet computer. You're like, what are the odds of that person being a killer?
Yeah, what are you doing? I've always walked past those people and looked at them like, what you up to?
Unless you're like 78 years old and this is just kind of how you use the internet and where you use it, which I kind of get at that point. But if you're like young and on the internet access computer at the library, you might be up to something. There should be like a permanent camera on the library at the computer and just like at every library and see how many criminals you catch. I bet it'd be high numbers. I really bet it would. But what about this? Do you think the gun was kept, again, pure conjecture here? Criminals don't often keep the murder weapon. But again, it kind of speaks to mindset here of, did he think he was too smart for the room and no one was going to go get him? Or did he want to keep that murder weapon because he wasn't done? Because he still had other grievances out there that had not yet been addressed. There still is the two pending civil lawsuits. I kind of been wondering if those folks might consider themselves lucky today to still be alive, that they weren't going to be coming up next.
Well, gosh, you know, on top of those points, Tony, sometimes these people have such an infatuation, or they're so consumed by some issue like a prior love that didn't work out how they wanted, that there are emotional attachments to the actions they take and the instruments with which they take them. And so I've seen before in cases where people have kept evidence from homicide scenes because of the emotional connection to them.
Yeah.
So that's possible. Did he have future plans? That's possible. Or is it not actually the murder weapon? That's also possible.
So any, it was like a souvenir. Doors.
Yeah.
A dark one, yeah.
Usually, but the thing is, usually it's not the weapon that's the souvenir. You know, if they find anything from the house, if he did take a souvenir, that's going to be really interesting and telling. Like, is there a piece of jewelry or something of hers that's at the house? That would be, I mean, there's just so much we don't know yet. But what we do know is pretty damning.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Michael McKee is a man who spent his entire adult life running from accountability. He ran from his marriage to Monique after just 7 months. He ran from a malpractice lawsuit in Nevada. Lawyers tried to serve him 9 times, showed up at his door, showed up at his job, and every single time, he was gone. A colleague at his old practice told him flat out, "I don't know where he is. He just disappeared." And now sitting in a Franklin County jail cell facing 4 counts of aggravated murder, Michael McKee has finally run out of road. Or has he? Here's the thing about men like this. Nothing will stop them from trying to convince you that your eyes are lying to you, that the story they've told is, of course, the truth. Anything else, that's just, it's nothing. It is nothing. The question isn't whether McKee will fight these charges. Of course he will. The question is how and whether the same personality traits that allegedly drove him to murder two people in their bed will be the very thing that convicts him. I believe it will. And I want to walk you through why. How is Michael McKee going to fight these murder charges in only the way a sociopathic narcissist would? I can't diagnose him. You can't either. Really, you know, unless you're right there, nobody really can. But if I were to guess, these are the traits that seem to be emanating from good old Michael McKee. In my opinion, what are your thoughts? So we're going to go through all of this. And as we do, I'd love for you to weigh in. You got two options to do so. You got the YouTube comments, Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi's, where you find us on YouTube to do just that, or directly with me in the studio on our Substack. Join us direct on there. Hiddenkillers.substack.com. The link is in the description to weigh in. It is absolutely free to join us on Substack right now, by the way. All right, let's start with what he's actually up against, because this matters. The evidence in this case isn't circumstantial. It's not thin. It's not ambiguous. Columbia police have publicly stated that shell casings recovered from the Tempe home have been matched through the National Integrated Ballistic Information Network to a firearm found at McKee's residence. They tracked his vehicle on surveillance, arriving in the neighborhood before the murders and leaving shortly after. They've confirmed that the shadowy figure walking through that alley in the footage released to the public, they say that's him. And then there's the silencer, a firearm suppressor, which tells you everything you need about to know about premeditation. I mean, it's a mountain. There's no such thing as an open and shut case or a slam dunk. There just isn't. But you don't accidentally buy a silencer. You don't casually attach one to a weapon you're bringing to a conversation. A suppressor exists for one reason: to kill quietly, to kill without waking the neighbors, to kill without alerting the children sleeping down the hall. The indictment reflects all of this. Four counts of aggravated murder, two for prior calculation and design, two for committing murder during the course of an aggravated burglary. Every single count carries a three-year firearm specification and a six-year suppressor specification. If convicted, McKee faces a minimum of 32 years before he's even eligible for parole. Maximum is life without the possibility of release. The prosecution built redundancy into this case. If a jury doesn't buy premeditation, the felony murder charges during the burglary provide a backup path to conviction. This is not a case with a lot of daylight for reasonable doubt. This is a case where the state is saying, pick your theory, either way, he's guilty. Again, what do you think? Tell me in the comments. So, what does a man like Michael McKee do when the walls are closing in? Well, based on his history, he does what he's always done. He runs, he denies, he blames everyone but himself, as a narcissist does. Before he can understand how McKee might defend himself legally, we need to understand who he is, not who he pretends himself to be or how he presents himself. A successful vascular surgeon, a man of medicine and prestige, but who he's shown himself to be through his own documented behavior. Let's talk about that malpractice suit, shall we? Because in September of 2024, according to court filings, a complaint was filed against McKee in Nevada. The lawsuit alleges that a physician's assistant under his supervision inserted a catheter incorrectly, leaving nearly nine inches of medical equipment inside a patient's body. McKee was named in the suit because under the legal doctrine known as captain of the ship, he was responsible for training and supervising that PA. Standard stuff in medical practice. Doctors get sued. That's why they carry malpractice insurance. This stuff happens. It doesn't mean you're a horrible doctor or a bad person. It just means, you know, shit happens. And you got the insurance to cover it, right? Right? Oh, you just don't want to face it. So you vanish into the night. That's unique. According to the plaintiff's attorney, they spent over a month trying to track him down. 9 separate attempts to serve him. They went to his home address, no answer. They went to his former surgical practice in Las Vegas. A colleague there reportedly said he had no idea where McKee was or how to reach him. The quote that made it into the news reports, he just disappeared. McKee was eventually served on January 6, 2026, 4 days before his arrest for double murder. Now let's talk about the marriage to Monique, because according to court records, they got married in August of 2015. By March of 2016, 7 months later, they were already living separately, off to a swimmingly good start. The divorce wasn't finalized until 2017, but the relationship was effectively over before it ever really began. Court documents show a mutual temporary restraining order was in place during the proceedings, which is fairly standard in many divorce cases, as courts routinely issue those to prevent either party from harassing the other or hiding assets. But family members have alleged the relationship was far from healthy, regardless of what the standard paperwork might suggest. Monique's brother-in-law, Rob Mislay, used the word torment in a media interview. He said the family was well aware of the negative impact McKee allegedly had on her, the abuse he allegedly put her through. A friend of Monique's told reporters that she would say she thought McKee would never leave her alone for the rest of her life. Why was she saying that? What was going on behind the scenes? So I want to pause on that for a moment. A woman who had been divorced for years, who had moved on, who had built an entirely new life, and according to people who knew her, she still lived with that fear. That is not the residue of a normal breakup. That's the shadow of something far darker. After the divorce, according to family members and those close to the situation, Monique moved on. She found Spencer. She fell in love. She got married. She had 2 children. She built a home filled with warmth and connection. What McKee did during those 8 years is less clear. What we do know, based on the allegations now before the court, is that he allegedly drove nearly 400 miles to her home in the middle of the night, carrying a suppressed firearm. Whatever was happening in his mind during those years, it allegedly culminated in murder. There's a framework in psychology called the Dark Triad. And we got some interesting videos on it on this channel. Siobhan Scott talks about it just in the last handful of days, if you go back on this case, if you want to really get into a deep dive with a psychotherapist about this, we did. It's worth watching. What is the Dark Triad? It's a cluster of 3 overlapping personality traits that researchers have identified as frequently appearing together in individuals who cause significant harm to others. It's not usually just one alone, because when the 3 of these things like interconnect, they're pretty powerful and spooky and scary and horrible if you're on the receiving end of it. The first of those traits, narcissism, grandiosity, an inflated sense of self-importance, a deep need for admiration paired with a profound lack of empathy. The narcissist believes they are special, superior, exempt from the rules that govern ordinary people. The second, Machiavellianism, named for Machiavelli, not Tupac on his album after he died, but Niccolo Machiavelli, the Italian diplomat who wrote that the ends justify the means. The trait manifests as manipulation, exploitation, strategic deception, and a cold, calculating approach to getting what you want regardless of who gets hurt. It's kind of the whole keep your friends close but your enemies closer sort of way of thinking. Weaponized. The third is psychopathy. Impulsivity in some cases, but more commonly a superficial charm masking a complete absence of remorse or guilt. The psychopath can mimic human emotion without actually feeling it. They understand what they're supposed to feel like. They just don't. They can act it out. They can make you think they feel that way. But when it actually comes down to those emotions truly driving or preventing behavior, it ain't there. And again, I want to be very clear here. I'm not diagnosing Michael McKee. I'm not a clinician. And if I were, I've never evaluated him. I have no way of knowing what's actually happening inside his mind. What I'm offering is a behavioral pattern analysis, the kind of framework that criminologists and forensic psychologists use when examining cases like this. And again, of which I am neither. It is not and should not be taken as a clinical diagnosis or statement of fact about McKee's mental state. This is an opinion. This is an analysis. Nothing more. So all two of you that are on Michael's side, there you go. With that caveat firmly in place, I think most of us can observe patterns of behavior based on what's been publicly documented. And when you look at McKee and how he's allegedly moved through the world, certain patterns are rather hard to ignore. Evading service 9 times while a lawsuit piles up, that suggests strategic avoidance, a refusal to face consequences. Allegedly keeping the murder weapon at his residence instead of depositing it, that suggests overconfidence. The belief that he was too smart, too careful, or too special to ever be caught. Although I do have something on that I want to bring up. Because I think all that is true, but I also don't think he was done. I think he was on the wound collector tour extraordinaire. And this was his first date. And the others got canceled because he got caught. I really do. And I'm wondering if the evidence will show that. Again, this is just my opinion, my conjecture, but if you were one of those folks who were bringing those lawsuits against him, consider yourself lucky. Because I think that gun was kept for a reason. I think he wanted to use it like a microphone, as an artist would do on their tour. Artists always have their mics. Like, don't mess with the artist mic. It's this one. It's marked this way. It's theirs. I think the gun was the same sort of thing. And wherever he found those people was his stage. Again, that's my conjecture. What do you think? Do you think he held onto the gun because he was going to keep going, because he was going to keep kind of like in a falling down style sort of way, keep taking out the people that had, in his mind, wronged him? That's what goes through my mind. I don't know. Call me crazy. I've just seen too many of these damn cases where there's reasoning for every move here. And this is a guy that thinks he's calculating and he's too smart for the room. So there's going to be a reason for every move. It may not make a lot of sense through the prism of a healthy mind, but if you go through his prism and his grievances and his wound collecting, oh, he wants to use, that's his. That weapon, that's like his teddy bear. And he's going to take it wherever he goes. Again, my conjecture. Curious about your thoughts on that. How about allegedly using that silencer to execute 2 people while they slept? Kind of suggests cold calculation, planning, the absence of the kind of empathy that would make such an act unthinkable. Allegedly spending 8 years unable to move past a 7-month marriage. That suggests an inability to accept rejection that would never heal in his mind, because that wound's not really about the other person. It's about the narcissist's own sense of self. And then there's what criminologist Dr. Casey Jordan calls the God complex, sometimes observed in surgeons. These are professionals who hold the line between life and death every day. They make split-second decisions that determine whether someone lives or dies. That kind of power, exercised repeatedly, can in some individuals warp a person's sense of their own importance. It can breed arrogance, and arrogance in a person already predisposed to certain traits can become something dangerous. Again, this is behavioral observation, not diagnosis. I'm offering a lens through which to view the alleged facts of this case. Others may see it differently, and that's totally fine. Here's what I think most people don't understand about narcissists. Based on the psychological literature, they don't just defend themselves in court. They defend themselves to themselves constantly against the unbearable weight of reality. So I sometimes say narcissism is neat, not because it's good or you want to practice it or you want to be one, but because when you study these people and look at them, you're just like, God, you really did twist it that far. And you really believe your shit, don't you? A narcissist, in many views, cannot psychologically afford to be guilty. Their entire identity is built in a foundation of superiority. They are the hero of their own story, always the victim, never the villain. So when reality contradicts that self-image, when the evidence says you allegedly drove the almost 400 miles in the middle of the night to murder your ex-wife and her husband while the children slept, the narcissist's mind doesn't accept it. It reframes it. Rationalization kicks in first. She ruined my life. She made me do this. If she had just stayed, none of this would have ever happened. The crime becomes a response to victimization, not an act of aggression. In his mind, he's not the monster. He's the wounded party who was just pushed too far. Then comes projection. Everyone's out to get me. The police are incompetent. My lawyers don't understand the situation. The media is biased against me. All fault is externalized. The narcissist is never the problem. The world is the problem. And the minimization follows. It wasn't as bad as they're making it sound. Things got out of control, but I didn't mean for it to go that far. The severity of the act is downplayed because fully acknowledging it would shatter that self-image. And underneath all of it, denial. Not performative denial for the cameras, but genuine cognitive denial. The narcissist may actually believe their own lies. The dissonance between I am a good person and I allegedly murdered two people is resolved by simply rejecting the facts. McKee appeared emotionless in his first court appearance. Multiple observers noted the flat affect, the blank stare. In my opinion, and I want to emphasize that this is my interpretation, not established fact, that reads not as shock or remorse, but as the detachment of a man whose internal narrative has completely separated from external reality. Others may see grief or confusion or the fog of disbelief. I see something colder, but that's my read, and I acknowledge it is subjective. So how does this translate to legal defense? What does a narcissist do when they're facing four counts of aggravated murder and a mountain of forensic evidence? Well, a competent defense attorney would tell McKee just to shut up, say nothing to anyone, ever. They tell him to carefully evaluate the evidence for weaknesses, chain of custody issues, procedural errors, anything that could create reasonable doubt. They tell him to seriously consider a plea. With evidence this strong, a negotiated sentence might be the best realistic outcome. They tell him under no circumstances to take the stand because cross-examination is a minefield for defendants, especially ones who think they're smarter than the prosecutor. And they tell him to show genuine remorse because juries are human beings who respond to humanity. That's what good legal advice looks like. And if followed, it saved narcissists in the past. Here's what a narcissist's ego typically demands instead. And I believe this is what we may see play out with McKay. He'll literally want to control the narrative. He'll want to tell his side because he genuinely believes that if people just understood the full context, they'd see things differently. They'd see that he's the real victim here. He'll likely want to challenge everything, not because it's strategically sound, but because admitting any piece of evidence is valid feels like conceding defeat. And narcissists don't concede. They fight even when fighting is self-destructive. He'll almost certainly resist any plea deal, in my estimation. Pleading guilty means admitting fault. It means accepting that he did something wrong. And for a narcissist, that's psychologically unbearable. It's easy to roll the dice. Much easier to roll the dice in a trial than to say the words, I am guilty, in open court. And I won't be surprised if he insists on testifying. His ego may convince him that he can charm the jury, that he can outmaneuver the prosecutor on cross-examination, that his intelligence and his credentials will somehow translate into credibility on the witness stand. There's a lot of Alec Murdaugh vibes going on here. This is where the dark triad type defendants often become nightmares for defense attorneys. They second guess every decision. They believe they're smarter than their lawyers. They refuse to follow advice that contradicts their self-image. They demand strategies that serve their ego rather than their acquittal. And when things go wrong, they blame counsel. I wouldn't be surprised if McKay cycles through multiple defense attorneys before this is over. Each one may hit the wall of his ego. Each one may tell him things he doesn't want to hear. And each one may eventually be fired or quit, blamed for failing to recognize his brilliance. That's speculation on my part, but it's speculation grounded in how these personality types behave in legal proceedings. Let's walk through the defense strategies that might theoretically be available and why, in my assessment, they're likely to fail. He could attack the forensics, challenge the Niben match, argue the shell casings were contaminated or planted. But Niben is highly reliable, and multiple weapons were recovered from his property. The math doesn't work in his favor. He could challenge the surveillance interpretation, claim that the figure in the alley could be anyone, assert that the vehicle might have been borrowed. But police have already confirmed McKay is the person in the footage, and the car was tracked from Columbus back to Rockford. Yeah, so there's that. He could try an alternative suspect theory, suggest someone else had access to his weapons, his car, maybe even knew the code to the house, but who? And why would that person target McKay's ex-wife 8 years after their divorce? He could admit presence, but deny the act. I was there, but I didn't kill them. I found them already dead, but that doesn't explain the silencer, doesn't explain the flight, doesn't explain why the murder weapon was allegedly sitting in his house. He could attempt a mental health defense, diminished capacity, temporary insanity. He snapped. He wasn't in his right mind. But the silencer destroys that argument completely. You don't purchase a suppressor, attach it to a firearm, drive 400 miles, enter a home in the middle of the night, and execute two people in a moment of temporary insanity. That's not a snap. That is a plan. You could try self-defense. Spencer attacked him. He had to protect himself. But according to the evidence, as described by police, Monique was shot in the chest. Spencer was shot multiple times. Neither was armed. McKay allegedly brought a suppressor weapon into their home at 2 a.m. That, again, not self-defense. It's called execution. Every strategy runs into the same wall. Premeditation. The silencer is the nail in the coffin of any defense that relies on spontaneity, passion, or mental break. Suppressors require forethought. They require acquisition. They require attachment. They require intent. And here's the cruel irony that I believe applies to defendants with these personality traits. The same characteristics that enable the alleged crime often ensures the conviction. McKay's apparent narcissism may have already hurt him in ways he probably doesn't even recognize. He allegedly kept the murder weapon. A rational person disposes of evidence. McKay kept it. Maybe because throwing away his gun felt like losing something. Maybe because he never truly believed he'd be caught. That is arrogance masquerading as invincibility. He allegedly didn't properly plan his escape. He drove his own vehicle. He didn't account for the surveillance cameras that blanket urban neighborhoods now. He allegedly returned to his normal life in Rockford, went back to work at the hospital as if nothing had happened, as if he hadn't just allegedly murdered two people 300 miles away. He created an 8-year trail of fixation. Assuming the allegations of obsessive behavior are accurate, the longer the gap between divorce and murder, the more evidence of obsession prosecutors can potentially introduce. Isn't that going to be fascinating? Social media monitoring, possible physical surveillance of the home, years of alleged stewing, fixating, watching her build the life he couldn't give her. All of it may come out in discovery. All of it may paint a picture of a man who never let go. That digital footprint is going to be telling, and there's 8 glorious years of it. If this is a man who was too stupid to get rid of the murder weapon, too arrogant to get rid of the murder weapon, do you think he pressed delete on his history? You never know. Sometimes you're like, you did that, but you didn't do this. We'll find out. But I would bet it, if he did, it wasn't done very well. His apparent narcissism will likely continue to haunt him, hurt him, and destroy him as we move closer to a trial, if we ever get there. He may insist on testifying. His ego may not let him sit silently while others tell the story wrong in his mind. He may believe he can charm the jury, that his intelligence will shine through under questioning. You know, as Alec Murdaugh, that worked out really well. Just get a lot of snot to come out. It works great every time, right? Cross-examination isn't a conversation, though. It's a trap. And prosecutors are very, very good at letting narcissists hang themselves with their own words. He may show no genuine remorse. Narcissists can fake empathy, but rarely well enough to fool 12 people staring at them for weeks. Something may slip, a smirk, a dismissive gesture, an eye roll when the prosecution presents evidence. Juries remember those moments. They remember them during deliberations when they're deciding whether this man deserves mercy. His flat affect may terrify them. Think of Koberger. Obviously, they never got to a jury. This may end similarly. This may end similarly. We may go through years of I love looking at the stars. And then finally, when it comes down to the last moment, you guys got me. What we saw in that first court appearance, that blank expression, that emptiness to a jury that often reads as coldness, as inhumanity, is exactly the kind of person capable of doing what he's accused of doing. And he may refuse to plea until it's too late. His ego may not let him admit guilt. He may convince himself that he can beat this. He may roll the dice on the trial. And in my opinion, the dice will come up life without parole. And here's what I'd call the tragedy of the narcissist. And I don't use that word to generate sympathy for McKee. He deserves none if these allegations are true. No sympathy. But it's a tragedy in the classical sense, the downfall caused by the protagonist's own fatal flaw. If convicted, even if sentenced to spend the rest of his life in prison, I believe Michael McKee will almost certainly never accept responsibility. Not publicly, not privately, not ever. In his mind, I suspect the narrative will calcify into something he can live with. The system was rigged against me. My lawyers were incompetent. The jury was biased. She pushed me to this. She had it coming. I'm the real victim here. He may spend decades in a cell, replaying the story, always casting himself as the wronged party in a drama of his own creation. Never once considering that he is not the protagonist, but the villain. Never once allowing the truth to penetrate the fortress of his ego. That is not accountability. That's not rehabilitation. That's not justice in any redemptive sense. That's just containment. Society protecting itself from a man who cannot be fixed because he refuses to acknowledge he is broken. Monique Tepe moved on. She built a beautiful life. She found a man who loved her, really loved her, and she married him in a small ceremony surrounded by the people who mattered. She had 2 children. She baked. She laughed. She created a home filled with warmth and connection. In her wedding vows, she said something that hits differently now. She talked about the journey that led her to Spencer, the bad dates, the wrong relationships, the waterfalls of tears. And then she said it was worth every cringing second because it led her to him. She got out. She survived for a time. She built something real. And if the allegations are true, Michael McKee couldn't stand it. He allegedly stayed frozen in 2016, trapped in the amber of his own narcissistic injury. While she was living, he was allegedly fixating. While she was growing, he was allegedly decaying. While she was loving her children and her husband and her life, he was allegedly planning how to destroy it all. And now he sits in a jail cell in Franklin County, Ohio, waiting for a trial he probably believes he can win. Defended by lawyers he may eventually blame when he doesn't. The same arrogance that may have made him think he could get away with murder is the same arrogance that may make him believe he can beat this case. The same inability to accept rejection that allegedly drove him to kill may be the same inability that prevents him from ever accepting a verdict. He will fight. I believe he will lose, and I don't think he will ever understand why. Because my experience studying these cases, narcissists never do. Your thoughts in the comment section on YouTube or on our Substack. YouTube, you can find us, Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. That's where you will find us. Join in that conversation. I'd love to get your thoughts. And Substack, that's where you can join us exclusively here in the studio, get access to all of our videos a day in advance, so you get tomorrow's reporting today. It's free, there's no paywall, and you can interact with us directly here in the studio through our chat. So please do check us out on Substack if you're not already there. And if you don't mind, leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. That helps us dramatically in the rankings and lets other folks know that you appreciate our reporting, and then lets other folks find us as well. So a few kind words there, very much appreciated on Apple Podcasts. Thank you in advance for that. All right, we'll continue our conversation off the air. I will see you there. Until then, my name is Tony Bruschi. We will talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers Podcast.